deadness, and apathy have lifted like storm clouds. In their place, I see a blue sky I forgot was ever there. I've finally been ungumped. All those nights I lay in bed during anhedonia, feeling like my heartbeat and breathing were fading to nothing. I wasn't dying or even close to it. My switching speed was simply slowing down, and the lack of constant stress, anxiety, and intensity felt alien to me. Suddenly I realize that the dichotomy between the false self and the authentic self that all these recovery people talk about is meaningless. It's a value judgment that's impossible to determine. A better way to think about it is the destructive self and the creative self, the you that damages your life and the lives of others, and the you that brings forth the best in yourself, is connected to others, and is in harmony with the world around you. All morning, I'm struck by epiphanies. It's as if by emptying out and then simply taking care of myself, truth is pouring in spontaneously and effortlessly without my having to consult experts to find it. You seem happier and more at peace than I've ever seen you, Rick says when I meet him for lunch at Coogie's a few days later. And there's something else different about you too, but I can't put my finger on it. He looks me over slowly, nodding as if giving a spiritual CAT scan. Maybe you healed something in you. He's not the first person to say that. Nearly everyone I've seen lately has noticed a change. Not in my appearance, but in my being. Things I never before thought I could change, such as my tendency to snap into anger when hemmed in by irrational rules, have completely evaporated. Where before I was anxious, frenetic, and nervous, now I'm more present, still, accepting. I'm hardly a Buddhist monk, but I'm more at peace with the world and with myself. I know, I tell him, I feel different. I thought this was just to change my beliefs about sex, but it shifted everything. How you do anything is how you do everything, Rick responds with a calmness that for once I mirror. Do you see now that the way you choose to live your life affects everything about it? A cheat here and there is not just a cheat here and there. It's a break in the continuum of who you are and the person you are in the world. I get that, I respond. I think I have a good understanding now of why I cheated. And why is that? The words sound vaguely challenging, like a test to make sure I really have changed. It's actually a list of things. I pull out my phone and show him a memo I wrote one night in bed during anhedonia. Why I cheated. 1. I didn't communicate or keep boundaries with Ingrid, so I acted out due to fear of engulfment. 2. I didn't share my sexual preferences with Ingrid or give her space to share hers, so I acted out due to unfulfilled sexual desires. 3. I blamed her for not allowing me to fuck other people, so I acted out due to a denial of personal responsibility for my behavior. 4. I had feelings of worthlessness and low self-esteem deep down, so I acted out for acceptance and validation. 5. I had no spirituality and a faulty intellectual paradigm, so I acted out because I believed we're no different from any other animal, and that's what animals do, and the consequences don't really matter to the universe. For once, Rick is speechless. A smile slowly spreads across his face, and after what feels like eternity, he tells me, I think you're going to understand what I mean now when I tell you the secret to being faithful. What's that? Don't trade long-term happiness for short-term pleasure. I add that phrase to my notes. It's a good mantra to remember. Think of intimacy as a fire, he continues. The more logs you add to it, the bigger it gets. And the bigger it gets, the less you want to throw water on it. My problem before, I tell him, was that the bigger the fire got, the more I wanted to throw water on it. I was so scared it would consume me. Rick studies my face. Words are easy to say, but am I capable yet of living by them? Another test percolates in his mind. He is a producer not just of music, but of lives. If things don't work out with Ingrid, he says, in order to give your next relationship a chance, I would recommend building intimacy and making a deep emotional commitment before beginning a sexual relationship. I think that should be your new challenge, to wait 3 months before having sex with your next girlfriend. He waits for my reaction. When I accused Rick and Lorraine of trying to castrate me after they first suggested anhedonia months ago, it only confirmed to them my unhealthy obsession with sex. This time, though, I don't overreact. If I want to have a heart-based relationship, his challenge makes sense. It takes time to let go of our projections and unmet developmental needs so we can see our partners as they really are and for them to see who we are. You know, 3 months sounds like a long time, I tell Rick, but if I'd done that in the first place, I probably wouldn't have wasted so many years of my life in the wrong relationships. Yet, as I speak those words, I feel a small flutter of discomfort with the idea and a rising fear from deep inside that surprises me. Will someone want to commit to me without the sex and the oxytocin of orgasm? This would mean that she'd actually have to like me for who I am. And a powerful voice from somewhere else inside me rises and cradles the fear like a child, telling it simply, yes, she will. Chapter 13. After watching John Frankenheimer's All Fall Down with my movie group that night, I'm struck by a troubling chain of thoughts. I emerged from anhedonia with not so much a decision, but a knowing that I was ready for an adult relationship with Ingrid. But what if I've changed so much that my wounds and her wounds are no longer complementary and we're not attracted to each other anymore? Or what if she's angry at me and just over it? Or what if she's madly in love with that James Dean guy? And even if she is single and doesn't hate my guts, how is she going to believe I've changed? I've told her that before, only to break her heart later. So I decide to bring proof to the wedding. I spend the next few days gathering the materials I need. In a box marked number 1, I insert a framed photograph of the survivor. "Thank you for the plant," I read on the back. "It has taught me that I can take care of things." The following packages are not gifts, but expressions of my commitment to you. I've worked hard on who I am and on becoming a better person. And I've learned that with love, anything can bloom. But with ambivalence and fear, a living thing will die. So no one who truly loves and is loved can ever be in a cage. In box 2, I place my old phone, along with a note explaining the new number, who I've given it to, and that I'm now giving it to the person I care most about in the world as well. Inside box 3 is the receipt for the program blocking all my social networking and the bounce-back message from my old email address. Box 4 takes half a day to prepare. I set up a spaceship room similar to the one she'd made in our old guest house and take a photo of it for her. Box 5 contains my most prized possession, my only key to the private beach where I surf, my version of the filing cabinet key of trust she gave me. And inside box 6 is a locket with a photo of me as a child on one side and a photo of her as a child on the other, with a message. Little Neil was scared. Adult Neil is not. The only fear he has is of losing you. Let's be great parents to our inner children together. I wrap each box and place them all in a larger box. I'm leaping out of the plane without a parachute, committing to her on the basis of faith alone, loving her without requiring her love. And either it's the most romantic thing I've ever done, or the most stalker-like. Possibly both. Some schools of attachment theory assess the way people behave in relationships on a continuum, rather than by clear-cut categories like in rehab. They place people on a graph divided into four quadrants, running from low anxiety to high anxiety on the x-axis, and high avoidance to low avoidance on the y-axis. Each quadrant determines a different attachment style. High avoidance and high anxiety would be fearful avoidance attachment, similar to love avoidance. High anxiety and low avoidance would be preoccupied attachment, similar to love addiction. High avoidance and low anxiety would be dismissing attachment, a more extreme form of love avoidance in which relationships are rejected almost altogether because no partner is perceived as worthy. So for fun, I take a test to determine which style I have, answering each question as honestly as I can. And I'm relieved when I fall into the fourth category, low avoidance and low anxiety. My analysis reads, combining your anxiety and avoidance scores, you fall into the secure region of the space. And though it's just an online test, it's also the first positive psychiatric evaluation I've had in a long time. I then read through my notes from the last few years. I look back on every conversation, meeting, book, appointment, intensive, and internal epiphany I've experienced. And I start writing a compendium of all the lessons I've learned. It is my center, an incomplete guide to love for the incomplete man, a map to success, not just in my relationships, but to safely handling all the outer and inner forces that can threaten them. It is my reminder to take care of myself, communicate my needs, stay away from the dark side, and keep from getting sucked back into my childhood reality. And it contains much more. Ways to cope with the urge to cheat, to avoid turning my partner into my parent, to prevent overreactions, to resolve conflicts, to make sure I'm growing closer to my partner over time instead of into a stranger. My progress on it, however, is interrupted by a soft knocking on the front door. "Who is it?" I ask cautiously, hopefully. "It's me," a woman's voice says shyly. "Ingrid?" "No," the voice responds. "It's Sage." Chapter 14.
Excerpts from An Incomplete Guide to Love for the Incomplete Man. Number 1. No matter what the situation may be, the right course of action is always compassion and love.
"I flew in to talk to you. Can you just open the door? I want to hide. I want to run. I can't let this get in the way of my plans." "But there are plans, and then there is life. And life trumps plans every time." "What are you doing here?" I ask as empathically as I can.
Number 2. As long as at least one partner is in the adult functional at any given time, most, if not all, arguments can be avoided.
"This is crazy, I know," Sage says. "I've been trying to reach you to apologize. I made a mistake. I love you." Pause. Silence. "I got scared, so I ran away. But I'm not scared anymore. I want to be with you. I hope you care about me enough to at least give me 5 minutes of your time." I hesitate for a moment, widening the space between the emotion I'm feeling and acting on it. The emotion I'm feeling is fear. I'm worried she'll do something that will affect my newly won clarity or my chances of getting back together with Ingrid. So I summon all my adult brain cells to a meeting in my neocortex and remind them that no one can hurt me without my permission.
Number 3. Recognize when you are backsliding into a childish or adolescent behavior. Then pinpoint what old story is being triggered and tell yourself the truth of the situation. Let go of the lie.
From a distant flank of my brain, however, the small, ragged remains of a once formidable army of guilt tries to invade. She flew all this way, so I must not disappoint her or hurt her. I squash the voice instantly as the pathological accommodation it is. The old belief that because my mom loves me, I must never do anything to make her suffer. And just about everything makes her suffer. Love is a cage. Only when you feel indebted to it, constrained by it, responsible to its owner.
Number 4. Accept what is.
With one army vanquished, the next attacks. The terror of self-doubt. What if this is how I sound when I see Ingrid? What if Ingrid thinks exactly what I'm thinking right now? What if she's right? What if? Today, I will expunge those two words from my vocabulary and replace them with, I will accept it if. I will accept it if this is how I sound when I see Ingrid. I will accept it if Ingrid thinks exactly what I'm thinking right now. I will accept it if she's right.
Number 5. Instead of saying, I'm never going to cheat again, say, today, I'm not going to do that thing that makes me feel weak and shameful about myself again.
And then, the final phalanx marches toward me, the most dangerous of all, desire. It tells me how great the sex with Sage was, and how fun the threesomes were. And I attack it with the best weapon there is, experience. I remind it that besides the lonely night with the twins, the adventure before that involved a neighbor who brought her giant husky over, and Sage and she made love while the dog tried to make love to me. Perhaps the corollary to Rick's secret is that the fantasy of other people is almost always better than the reality. I open the door and guard the threshold. Sage stands before me in full club makeup and a black dress, with her hair freshly dyed and her legs perfectly tanned. She's clearly spent a lot of time working on herself. And more worryingly, there's a suitcase at her feet. She reaches out to hug and kiss me, and I back away. I will not feel sorry for her. I will not be turned on by her.
Number 6. You can't have a relationship with someone hoping they'll change. You have to be willing to commit to them as they are with no expectations. And if they happen to choose to change at some point along the way, then that's just a bonus.
Words start tumbling out of her mouth, concluding with her desire to move in and start a family with me. It sends a chill up my spine, because this is exactly what I want with Ingrid if things work out between us. You want to move in, stay with me forever, and start a family together? Yes, she says, her eyes widening with equal parts sincerity and supplication. I picture what the future would actually be like with Sage. I imagine us married and raising children, until one day, when she feels trapped again, she runs away to Fiji without warning, leaving me to explain to the kids that mommy left to search for herself, and I don't know when she's coming back. The winds of ambivalence will continue blowing her back to me, and away again, back and away, back and away. They say that love is blind, but it's trauma that's blind. Love sees what is.
Number 7. Communicate and maintain healthy boundaries. This means finding the proper balance of filtering and protecting yourself, thoughts, feelings, time, and behaviors without either closing off behind walls or becoming overwhelmed or overwhelming.
She looks forlorn and expectant, and every now and then, tears fall from her eyes as she tells me that she spent her savings to fly out here. Until recently, this was my nightmare, having to meet other people's expectations, especially when doing what's right for me hurts someone else's feelings. But it was her choice to come here, so there's nothing to feel guilty about. This is my chance to implement the boundaries I've learned, to enforce them when they're trespassed so I don't feel enmeshed, to break old habits and reinforce new ones. This isn't cool, I tell her. You can't just come by without letting me know. But your phone number wasn't working, she replies. How can you be so cold? You said you loved me. It doesn't just go away like that. She has a good point. I flash back to Lorraine's words. You won't get hurt playing with toys, but they will. I have a lot of love for you, I tell her, but the relationship just, I don't know how to best put it, is over. It ended exactly when it should have.
Number 8. Ask yourself throughout the day, what do I need to do in this moment to take care of myself? If you can be aware of what legitimate needs and wants you're not attending to, and then take actions to meet them on your own, or ask your partner for help if you can't, that is the road to happiness.
Is there someone else? She asks. There is, but she won't talk to me. Is this a joke? She exclaims. You're crazy. I used to be crazy, I tell her. I think I'm finally getting sane. Can I at least sleep here? She asks. She takes a step closer, and I inhale her unique blend of pomade, sex, and moisturizer.
Number 9. No one can make you feel anything, and you don't make anyone feel a certain way. So don't take on responsibility for your partner's feelings, and don't blame your partner for yours. The most caring thing to do when they're upset is simply to ask if they want you to listen, to give advice, to give them space, or to give them loving touch.
What? It's amazing. Even when you set a boundary, people still want to trample across it. She says, I have nowhere to stay. Can I at least stay in the spare bedroom and we can talk when you're ready? I remind myself. She says, I took a cab from the airport. That Sage is not my mother. And she says, I promise I'll leave after we talk. I am not responsible for her happiness. So I draw the boundary more firmly. It's not okay to stay here. I'm sorry, but I made a commitment to myself, and I need to honor it.
Number 10. Love, honor, and affirm yourself. Whatever your decisions, actions, feelings, and thoughts throughout the day may be, and whatever outcome they may lead to, if you are healthy, then they are ultimately healthy.
The words register on her face, and she starts to protest. The old me would want to hug her, to say we can talk later, to let her crash here, to promise that we can still be friends, to make any number of mistakes. But now, all that goes through my mind is a question. Is it in my highest good? And none of these is in my highest good. So I remain resolute like stone, and she melts into water. The tears mix with her mascara, running black down her face. They are not my problem. They are her problem. And she will get over it. Or she won't. But the most compassionate thing I can do is let her make her own decision based on the truth. And the truth is that I love Ingrid. I just hope that Ingrid loves me.
Number 11. And, above all, always remember to breathe and be in the moment.
But I will accept it if Ingrid doesn't. Chapter 15. I stand outside the unheated garage where Ingrid's stepdad made her live with nothing but an old, torn-out car seat as furniture, while her brother and stepbrothers lay on warm beds in warm rooms. I make sure my jacket sits firmly on my shoulders. My purple shirt cuffs jut ever so slightly out of the sleeves. My matching tie is just a touch off center, and the bottoms of my pants hang neatly over my shoes. I am Sage. I've come begging. I walk through the kitchen, where Ingrid's stepfather made her cook and scrub for hours every day, punishing her if she dared to sit down. She was allowed to eat only after the rest of the family finished their meal. At the end of the kitchen, there's a door to the backyard, where Ingrid's stepfather would force her to chop the heads off chickens, and would laugh as she vomited at the horror of the act. She is my Cinderella, and hopefully in her fairy tale, I am the frog she has kissed and transformed into a prince. I look around for her, the box I wrapped last night in my arms. There are two long tables decorated with flowers, surrounded by women in red dresses and men in dark suits. Four of those men are her stepbrothers. I hope Ingrid's been telling them nice things about me, but somehow I doubt it. I circle the yard looking for Ingrid, hopeful not to see James Dean, and careful not to make eye contact with any of her stepbrothers. But she's nowhere to be found. I don't belong here. I should leave. Hey, brother, I hear a voice saying. I turn around and see Hans near the bar, waiting for the ceremony to begin. I congratulate him and thank him for inviting me. I want to ask why he sent me the invitation, but I'm afraid he's going to say it was an accident. His hand presses against the small of his back, and he stretches as if in pain. When I ask if he's okay, he looks around furtively, making sure no one else can overhear. Then he tells me he went to a strip club with his friends for a surprise bachelor party the night before. He got so drunk that he started dancing on the pole and carrying two strippers across the stage. But he fell, dropped the dancers, and threw out his back. Don't tell my bride, he cautions. She doesn't know? He smiles at me conspiratorially. I told her I heard it at work. And so another marriage is born with a lie. It is the great lie that husbands and wives have no sexual interest in anyone except each other. I know deep down that I haven't conquered my desire for other women. I don't think that's possible without getting Hasi Wallam to lower my testosterone levels. But I've removed what was psychological, the fear of loving, the terror of being loved, the compulsion to cheat, the cowardice of lying, the weak sense of self, the pathological accommodation, and all the defense mechanisms that kept this system in place and me too blind to see it. I want to ask Hans where Ingrid is, if she knows I'm coming, and if she's excited or angry or nervous or just doesn't care. But this is his day, his passage into a new life, so I leave him to prepare for it. That's when I see their mother, who gave up a television career in Mexico to become a housewife in the United States. She sacrificed everything to get away from the cheating first husband who tried to murder her. But his replacement rarely lets her leave the house, have any friends, do anything but chores, or even be a mother to Ingrid and Hans. She is trapped not in the past, but in a fear her future will replicate her past. So in the end, perhaps her ex-husband did kill her. She lives in a coffin in Sylmar. Its headstone reads, Security. Yet even she cheats, though she doesn't see it as such. Sometimes she tells her husband that she's going to see a neighbor, but instead sneaks out to see Ingrid and Hans, the children she had with her first husband. Jealousy is an unforgiving adversary, still controlling the border long after it has won the war. I am back in the reality of relationships, where partners bend the rules and tell little white lies to get their needs met. The ideal I've been striving for is not the way people have relationships in the real world. Perhaps, as I promised my friends in rehab, I actually have gone out and designed a new type of relationship, yet not one in which I get to fuck all the women I want, as I'd hoped, but one in which I live in truth and without fear or guilt. I think about how I snuck out on Ingrid so long ago, telling her I was going to Marilyn Manson's house the night before our trip to Chicago, the night before her birthday, and I feel disgust with myself for ever having done that. I used to think I was a good person, but how could a good person do something so reprehensible? The answer? Compartmentalization. the act of putting shameful activities in a small sealed box in our brain, where they remain safely hidden, even from our own intelligence and conscience. I hope her mom's not upset I'm here. Congratulations, I tell her slowly. She doesn't speak English. Her current husband never let her take lessons, though she understands basic words. You must be very proud of Hans. She smiles with a delicacy that reminds me of Ingrid, and then says softly, "She needs you." They are the only English words I've ever heard her speak. I stand before her stupidly for a moment, fighting down the surge of emotion. "We need each other," I sputter. She nods wisely and kindly at me, as only a mother can, a mother who sees something that her children are too inexperienced to recognize. And that's when I spot her, emerging from the back porch of the house, all white and all blonde, a color combination shared by no one else at the wedding. She is pale like a ghost, but radiant like a goddess. She's not just more beautiful than I remember. She's more exquisite, commanding, otherworldly. It's too far away to see the expression on her face as she steps into the darkness between the back stairs and the party. Hercules follows obediently, wearing a red bow tie. I break into a wide smile and hope to see it reflected back in her face. As she comes closer, I don't detect anger or fear or disappointment or disgust or any of the emotions I was afraid she'd have. She too is smiling. I've been so stupid. This is the one, I tell myself. This is the woman I'm going to marry. I just hope I've truly changed. Chapter 16. Excerpt from Ingrid's Mind.
And there he walks through the crowd of a Mexican fiesta. I recognize his shirt and tie. They're the same ones he's worn at almost every book signing since I've known him. Purple shirt and purple tie hugging his body. I quickly run into the house and bypass my aunt, who's waiting for the bathroom. As soon as the door opens, I stumble in, pushing everyone out of the way, so I can look at myself one last time before he sees me. I check my hair, reclip my extensions, fix my push-up bra, and debate whether to use pink lipstick or keep the red. Red screams, "Take me, you fool, and kiss me passionately." And pink says, "These lips are delicate and soft. Handle with care." So I choose the red. I leave the bathroom and walk through the kitchen. But when I see my reflection in the stainless steel refrigerator door, I quickly grab a napkin and rub off the red lipstick. Then I put on the pink. And now it's a mess and my lips say, "Take, fool, kiss, delicate handle." The last year was hard for me. When Neil and I broke up, I felt like everything I had was taken from me. I was angry and disappointed because I gave and gave and gave, and then I was left with nothing. I felt disconnected from the world. There was an emptiness in my chest. I kept trying to figure out what was wrong with me that would cause him to do that. I dated a lot to forget the feeling. I rebounded with the bartender slash underwear model. But one day after we had sex, he pretended like he was a gorilla, flaring his nostrils and pounding his chest while naked for an uncomfortably long period of time. I grabbed my clothes, left politely, and never saw him again. After that, I met a sweet guy who wrote speeches for presidents. I just wanted to have fun and not feel the pain, but he wanted more from me than I was ready to give. So I broke up with him, then started dating a magician I met at the Magic Castle. When I split up with him, I realized that maybe the relationship I needed to be in was with myself. When Neil texted me from Machu Picchu, I wanted to run back into his arms. But I was scared I'd be cheated on again. And I wasn't ready. I'd just broken up with everyone and felt too vulnerable. Being alone was the best thing I ever did for myself. I've always gone from one relationship to another, hoping the other person would help me figure out who I was or complete me and make me feel whole. But it never worked out that way. When the other person didn't make me feel whole, I was left with an even bigger emptiness inside. It took the pain of the last year to realize that I needed to stop being a half, trying to find my other half, but to be a whole on my own. I had to learn how to love myself. I had to learn to value myself, and I had to learn that I mattered. I'm not sure if I'm whole yet, but I'm more complete. And so when Hans asked me for help thinking of wedding guests, I suggested Neil. I told Neil that if he ever texted me, "Freedom!" I would be there. I didn't say when. I had to be ready too. And so I made and sent him the invitation myself. I wanted to see him one more time, just to be sure I wasn't making a mistake and walking away from the love of my life. Before leaving the kitchen, I stand behind the window and try to catch one last glimpse of Neil before our eyes meet. My hands are sweating and I feel a sudden rush of anxiety. There's still time for me to call a taxi and leave, or run through the front door and climb up my favorite tree, where I used to hide from my stepdad as a kid. I'm worried that this is a mistake. As my grandmother used to say, you can't change a person unless they're in diapers. Though another one of her favorite sayings is, with patience, even the grass becomes milk. Being with Neil felt like having the most beautiful bird from the Amazon, filled with colors and life, but kept in a cage that was too small for his wings to spread. I'd sit next to the cage every morning and sing with him, but he was always looking at the window. I told him when we separated that it was time to open the cage and set the bird free. But every morning afterward, I looked through the window and hoped to catch a glimpse of him flying by. So here I am, looking through the kitchen window and into the yard, and I see Neil flying outside. I see his tender eyes and his sweet smile. He touches his face just below his left eye, with his index and middle finger rubbing back and forth. And as I smile at the memory of that nervous tick of his, I open the screen door and step outside to fly with him. I just hope he's changed.
Door 5. Freedom. I will die kissing your crazy cold mouth, caressing the lost fruit buds of your body, looking for the light of your closed eyes. And so when the earth receives our embrace, we will go blended in a single death, forever living the eternity of a kiss. Pablo Neruda, Cien Sonetos de Amor.
Chapter Infinity. The survivor sits on my window ledge, brilliantly green and thriving. Beneath it, Ingrid and I sit on a couch that's been cleaned obsessively, removing all DNA traces of communes, triads, and open relationships. Hercules is sprawled on the floor next to a beautiful white Maltese dog that Ingrid also rescued. On the table, there's a box wrapped in silver paper. I undress it, slit the packing tape with a pen, and open the cardboard flaps. There are 5 small wrapped presents inside, each marked with a different number. A scroll of burnt parchment lies on top of them. Go ahead, read it, Ingrid urges. Ladies and gentlemen, you are cordially invited to the funeral of our greatest and biggest room fixture, Jacob the Elephant Goff, age 3, of Malibu, California. A celebration of life service will be held today at 9 p.m. in the community where he lived uninvited. Mr. Goff the Elephant will be buried with some of his most precious items. Sincerely, Freedom and Trust Mortuary. At first, I don't understand. Why are we burying an elephant? She places her hand warmly over mine. You worked hard to win back my trust, so I've been working hard to forgive. It's the elephant in the room, my past cheating, sneakiness, and lying. And just as I gave Ingrid a present at her brother's wedding to prove that I've changed, the 5 individually wrapped boxes in front of me 3 months later are her way of saying that so too has she. Though Disney cartoons and romance movies end the moment the lovers reunite, leaving the audience to assume they lived happily ever after, in real life, this is the moment the story truly begins. It's when Sleeping Beauty asks Prince Philip, "How many princesses did you kiss while I was asleep?" It's when the Little Mermaid yells at Prince Eric, "An enchantment spell? That's the worst excuse I've ever heard. You were about to marry that other girl." It's when the princess who kissed the frog asks the resultant prince, "Be honest, while you were a frog, did you have sex with any female frogs?" Without the intensity to keep them busy, the common enemy to unite them, or the obstacles to intensify their longing, these legendary lovers now face the biggest challenge of all, dealing with each other, and the differences, be they great or slight, in their values, upbringings, opinions, personalities, expectations, preferences, and imperfections, especially when the aftermath of every such adventure is trauma. And so, as one might expect, Ingrid did not freely give me her trust after we reunited. On our first day back together, she threatened to leave if I didn't change my social networking status to reflect that I'm in a relationship, even though I no longer have access to the account. On the second day, she threatened to leave after seeing photos of Sage on my computer. On the third day, she threatened to leave if I didn't let her look through my phone. And on the fourth, she said that the memories of the past were too painful for her to want to date me again. That's when I realized that as a love avoidant, I'd placed Ingrid on a pedestal, thinking that because she was so attached and I wasn't, she must somehow be better at love than I. But in reality, she was just sitting on the other end of the same dysfunctional seesaw. After all, she has at least one fatal flaw we both agree on. She chose me as I was back then. I never saw it before, but I definitely have a pattern too, she realized when we discussed this. My boyfriend before you was totally enmeshed by his mother. She'd call all the time, asking him to do things for her, and he'd drop everything to take care of her. I stayed with him for 5 years, even though he never let me use the word boyfriend, or say we were dating, or even see him more than twice a week. And so I found a former colleague of Lorraine's named Vince, zipped up my wetsuit, and watched as he put Ingrid in the chair and began the process of healing the father abandonment wounds that led to her love addiction. As she sat yelling at her father, tears streaming down her face, I realized that we had the exact same parents, enmeshing moms and abandoning dads. Except where my mother wants my father dead, her father actually tried to kill her mother. It's odd how relationships work like that. Love is not an accident. It is a delicate union of two complex, complementary puzzle pieces that have inadvertently been created by different manufacturers. I was told, when it's love at first sight, run in the other direction. And I tried that, but I ran right back into her. And now, as we sit side by side, starting down a new path together, I unwrap the gift marked number one. Inside, there's a small wooden coffin lined with white satin. Ingrid's handwritten instructions say to leave it open. The second gift is a small gray plastic elephant. The note with it reads, "This is the elephant in the room. He will no longer be in the room with us because he will be resting in his coffin. The fear, doubt, and anger he created will no longer hurt us or be intrusive to the love we have for each other. I love you." My face swells as I place the elephant in the coffin on its side. It fits snugly, its feet and trunk close to the edges. The next package contains two small metal bird cages, each with tiny metal birds in them. The cages symbolize being restrained, unable to speak your mind, misunderstood, and alienated, Ingrid's note explains. These two beautiful birds, placed inside cages with nowhere to go, left alone and lonely, symbolize us as children, as teenagers, and as adults. We are bearing this because we are no longer alone or lonely. We have the freedom to fly anywhere we want. Awed by her wisdom, thoughtfulness, and creativity, I place the two caged birds in the coffin, one at the elephant's head and the other at its rear. In such a short amount of time, and with much less struggle, Ingrid is already on this journey with me. And together, we are learning that, to paraphrase the relationship writer Harville Hendrix, the unconscious purpose of a long-term relationship is to finish childhood. Or, as psychiatrist Eric Byrne put it even more succinctly, love is nature's psychotherapy. The next gift contains a dozen miniature metal hands. The hands symbolize judging, lack of boundaries, and control. This next note reads, "This is how we felt as children and sometimes as adults. Today, we are burying this and letting go of the people who pointed fingers at us, the people who tried to control us, our own lack of boundaries, and our attempts to control each other." I sprinkle the hands over the elephant, the cages, the coffin floor. The fifth package contains two metal keys with words on them, secrets and memories. "These are the bad keys," her parchment explains. "The secrets key means we no longer have to keep secrets for anyone who ever hurt us. When this key is buried, we will let go of the secrets that are hurting us inside and no longer take on responsibility for other people's problems. The memories key is for our bad memories. We are letting go of our attachment to them. We will no longer keep these memories locked up inside and allow them to rule us." As I slide the keys around the elephant, I finally understand what the true intimacy that Joan spoke about in rehab actually is. It's when partners stop living in the past, in their trauma history, and start having a relationship with each other in the present moment. Love, it turns out, is not something to be learned. It's something we already have, and we must unlearn in order to access it. Her instructions then read, "Take a moment or two before closing the coffin. You will not be able to open it once it is closed, so take pictures and do whatever you want for the next few minutes or hours, but close it before the day is over." I stare at the coffin and the beautifully, carefully thought out items inside. I look at the little elephant, the trapped birds, the many hands, and finally, the keys, until a single word in the coffin fills my vision: secrets. And I think that if I truly want the past buried, now is the time to set free any last secrets. The moment is so perfect, but like everything perfect, it is fragile. I tell her nervously, awkwardly, slowly, "I want you to know that there was other bad stuff in the past besides Juliet, the woman I cheated with. I didn't know then that I couldn't still love you and sneak around behind your back. I didn't understand, but I understand now." As she takes this in, her face freezes and her spine stiffens, like a cat reacting to a sudden noise. I look at the secrets key and think of what else I'm holding back. "I know you dated some people while we were apart, and I just want to let you know that besides some of the stuff we've already discussed, I had a lot of other experiences." "What kind of experiences?" she asks warily. The beautiful solemnity of the ritual is shattering. But this is what it means to tell the truth. It is to give someone else her freedom, to allow her to have a reaction, even if it leads to negative consequences for you. To give her the voice that lying takes away. In the past, I've had a remarkable gift for turning even the most minor manifestation of fear or disapproval from my partner into a personal catastrophe. But instead, I use the four adjustments to turn shame into reassurance. Shame is about being bad for someone. Reassurance is about being good to yourself. And not only does it make more sense to respond with compassion instead of criticism, it's also much easier on everyone involved. It may be the key to a longer, happier life. I tell Ingrid about the Pali people and learning the four adjustments and the concept of relationships based on intents. I tell her about the swingers and learning that my sexual fantasies can add to a relationship if I include my partner in them rather than trying to protect her from them. I tell her about the harem house and learning that love is not a terrifying monster making unreasonable demands on my life, but a beautiful friend making occasional requests that I have the option to accept or deny. And I tell her about the open relationship and learning not just to let go of jealousy and control, but to explore my painful emotions rather than avoiding them like an addict. As Ingrid listens, she oscillates through a spectrum of feelings, anger, fear, sadness, until finally she lands on love. I never thought I'd say this. She sighs, sliding closer to me and stroking my head. But maybe all those things you did weren't a relapse after all, but were part of the healing. I'd like to think so, I reply. As Lorraine once put it, recovery is not about perpetually living in joy and harmony, but about shortening the time it takes to return there when you inevitably fuck it up. And for this reason, I'm grateful for the opportunity that every conflict Ingrid and I have provides to practice this. It's just incredible how different you are now, Ingrid says after I share this with her. You're much more calm and mature and patient and understanding. Sometimes I'm waiting for you to get upset or annoyed, and it doesn't come. It's magical. You're like a butterfly. You spun your little cocoon, and you transformed. Even your eyes are different. I can see your heart through them. Most love stories are about two people who belong together, but are blocked by an obstacle keeping them apart. Their cultures, their social standing, their families, a rival lover, a manipulating villain, an unexpected tragedy. But in real life, love stories are more complex. People want love, but after they get it, they become scared or bored or uncertain or resentful. And when they get pain instead of love, they don't leave. They cling to it more strongly than they would to pleasure. And so in life, the real obstacle keeping two lovers apart is not external. The battle to be fought is within. And so, I think as I take in Ingrid's words, in the end, love is not about finding the right person. It's about becoming the right person. I put my hand on the lid of the coffin. This is it, I tell her. We're saying goodbye to the past. Is there anything else you want to know? Let's close it, she says. First, I take a photo, and then I shut the lid. The elephant in the room is gone. There's one last package, Ingrid says. She hands me a palm-sized box that she's kept separate from the rest of the gifts. Inside are a note and four keys of various shapes and sizes, each with a different word on it. These are the good keys, the ones you keep, the note reads. The love key is to remind you that you are worthy of love and you always have access to my love. The heart key is the key to the biggest heart on earth, yours. The life key is the key to opening our lives for each other. And the journey key is for the path to our happiness. While reading these beautiful words, I notice the complete absence of my old feelings. Suffocation from her love. Doubt that I have a good heart, fear of opening our lives to each other, and anxiety about her expectations of me. Instead, every word rings like truth. Neither haunted by the past nor worried about the future, I'm finally grateful for the present. It turns out that relationships don't require sacrifices. They just require growing up and the ability to stop clinging to immature needs that are so tenacious they keep the mature needs from getting met. I find some paracord in the kitchen, thread a length of it through the keyring, and hang it around my neck so I can keep the keys close to my heart. "I trust you with these keys," she says. "I will be worthy of them this time," I respond. There's one last instruction on the scroll: to bury the coffin. Unable to find my shovel in the garage, I grab two large spoons from a kitchen drawer instead. In the backyard, on top of a hill so small it's more of a bump, there's a soft patch of dirt surrounded by fragments of discarded slate. We kneel around it and start scooping. The dirt is soft and yields easily. We dig until the grave is 10 inches deep, safe from being discovered by the treehouse's next tenants. In olden days, this was supposedly a Chumash burial ground. We throw a spoonful of dirt over the coffin, and she says a few words. "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to bury Jacob the elephant Goff. He was a very loyal companion. He never left our sides. We wanted to get rid of him, but he turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to us. Without this elephant, we wouldn't have each other. May God have mercy on his soul." We fake cry as we gather the dirt spooned around us and fill the hole until the elephant is gone and buried without a trace of its existence left above ground. Then we share a moment of silence, basking in the solace of letting go. Ingrid speaks first. "Uh-oh, I accidentally buried my car keys." I laugh, squeeze her tightly to me, and kiss her between the sparkling, mischievous eyes I so sorely missed. "I love making you laugh," she grins. "You have this amazing smile and your cheeks fill up. I have this picture in my head of us as old people and me doing something to make you laugh." "I picture that too," I respond. "And if I had the choice between laughing or having different foursomes for the rest of my life, I'd take the laughing every time." I kind of want to call Juliet and tell her, "Thanks for everything," Ingrid says as we walk back to the house. As I take her hand in mine, I realize that before trauma healing, I always wanted more. More women, more success, more money, more space, more experience, more possessions. Not once did I stop and say, as I do now, "I have enough."
Epilogue. When the wild card is played, is it still wild?
We drive in silence, my father and I. It is my last day as a single man. I wait for him to give me advice, to say something about my impending wedding, to offer anything he's learned from 50 years of marriage. But he says nothing. I suppose I shouldn't have expected anything different. He never told me about the birds and the bees until I was 22, and his advice was, take your time, go slow, and don't rush it. To break the silence, I ask what his father was like. "He was very quiet and didn't say much," he replies. "He usually worked all the time." "What's your favorite memory of him?" "I guess it was when we were fishing together one day, just in silence." I think about how lonely that must have been, and I suppose, in correlation, how lonely I was. "What about your mom? What's your favorite memory of her?" He struggles to remember something about his mother, who was a busy Chicago socialite. I guess I don't have any strong memories of her, either positive or negative. In my enmeshing conversations of old, we would discuss the theory that because Dad's mother was self-absorbed and his sister was the family favorite, his self-esteem was so low and his fear of women so great that he felt as if the only people he could have power over were the helpless, the handicapped. Clearly, on some level, my foray into the world of seduction, to get what I believed was a psychological advantage over women, was my own attempt to do the same. I did have a live-in babysitter, though, he adds, and I guess we were closer. I'm surprised to hear how similar our childhoods were, with a distant father, narcissistic mother, favored sibling, and a babysitter raising us. And I think about how similar our adult lives almost were. My relatives often tell the story of a family portrait I drew in kindergarten. Sketched in crayon on construction paper, there are stick figures representing myself, my little brother, our babysitter, and each of my parents. Then there's a large red line that begins in the center of my father's legs, drops straight to the ground, and finally stretches out in a wide circle around the family. It is my father's penis. Even back then, I somehow knew that our entire family was subordinate to its influence, living in the shadow of its enormity. And so there is one question that's burning my insides. I work up the guts to ask my father and get some closure on the subject after more than 2 decades. So, how did you become obsessed with people with physical disabilities? That's what I want to ask, but I don't. Whatever his answer may be, it's a discussion his wife should be having with him, not me. The part of it that concerns me, growing up around a marriage rotted by it, is over with. I reflect on something Ingrid told me the day I knelt in the sand on a deserted beach in Kauai and asked her to marry me. You didn't come from a loving family, she said. I didn't come from a loving family. But now we have a chance to make a loving family together. My father and I lapse back into silence. We haven't quite bonded. I don't know if that's even possible. I can't recall him ever being comfortable with emotional intimacy or physical affection. Trying to bash my head through his wall will only result in brain damage. But at least I've knocked on his door for the first time to see if he wants to let anyone in. Lately, I've started thinking of the things my parents didn't do perfectly as variables that make me an individual rather than as trauma that makes me a patient. It's not healthy to walk through life identifying oneself as a victim and others as perpetrators. Your mother wants to talk to you, my dad says when we return to the beach house Ingrid and I are renting for the wedding. She sits in an armchair with her feet up and a cane at her side. Is there going to be a photographer at the wedding? She asks. Of course. Her face tilts to disapproval. Did you tell him not to take any photos of me? I did. This is the only request of hers I honor. Since she found out about my dad's fetish, she hasn't allowed anyone to take a single photo of her. I used to think I was so beautiful, she sighs, but now I just feel like a freak. In rehab, I told my group how I used to try to convince her otherwise, to tell her that if she were blonde and Dad had a fetish for blondes, she'd be completely fine with it. But this time, I let the comment pass unnoticed, as she herself wants to be, and I accept the fact that she is too old to change. One day soon, she won't be here anymore. In the notes about love that I compiled during anhedonia, one of the most important was not to date someone hoping she'll change. So perhaps I can apply the lesson to my relationship with her also and accept her as the person she is, not the one I'd like her to be, and be grateful that she loved me as much as she knew how. Thanks so much, I tell Rick when he visits on the morning of the wedding. You made this possible. I don't want any of the blame, he responds. Any blame would be on me. On this we agree. We walk outside to the patio and sit on deck chairs facing seaward. At one point, I was ready to give up and stop discussing all this with you, he says, looking over the ocean to the horizon. It's tragic. The wounds that humans get are so strong that they're like robots operating on childhood programming. And even if they learn the truth about themselves in therapy and rehab, they still cling to their false beliefs and make choices that don't serve them, over and over again. He shakes his head at the cosmic absurdity of it all. It takes hard, conscious, diligent work to genuinely change. I have a feeling it's the closest thing to a wedding congratulations I'm going to get from Rick, so I accept it as such. The reception, Ingrid and I agreed, should be small, so that we actually have time and energy to pay attention to each other. I've invited only the people who made it possible. My immediate family, Rick, the Red Demons, close friends like Melanie, and a few dating coaches and relationship healers. The former gave me the tools to meet Ingrid, the latter to commit to her. However, Lorraine, to whom I owe more thanks than anyone, never RSVP'd to the invitation. I made some calls to find out what happened to her. From what I could gather, she was disciplined for having what's known as a dual relationship with clients, both social and therapeutic. So now she's in a more administrative role at the hospital, and not unlike Adam, she's too scared to leave and spread her wings on her own. Yet I hope that one day I'll be able to speak with her again and thank her for saving my life, just as she has saved the lives of countless others. Beyond showering, shaving, and putting on a tuxedo, there's not much for me to do to prepare for the wedding. So in the afternoon, Adam, Calvin, and Troy come by the house and we change into swimsuits. "How are you doing with the whole monogamy thing?" Troy asks as we walk down the hillside to the beach together. "You know, I think I blew it up into too big a deal. I hate to say this, but Joan was right. I was just throwing intellectual barriers in my way to avoid being vulnerable and committed. In a big, connected world, it's easy to find enough people with the same trauma profile to agree with you, then simply discount, ignore, or attack all evidence to the contrary. But what about the male dilemma? The whole sex gets old and so does she thing?" Troy asks. "And I'm embarrassed for ever having thought of anything so shallow and misguided." "I think that's only true if two people see each other as objects or employees," I reply. "If they're emotionally healthy adults, then there's no dilemma that they can't work out together. They're not going to even notice each other aging, but just getting happier." I pause to reflect on it. What I saw as getting old before wasn't truly a fear of physical decline, but a fear of becoming unhappy like my parents. And I'm definitely not worried about that anymore. "Growing older and happier with Ingrid," I continue, "is one of the things I'm most looking forward to in life right now." A strange thing happened. As I dealt with my enmeshment issues, I became less concerned about wanting sex outside the relationship. And as Ingrid dealt with her abandonment issues, she became less concerned about losing me if I happened to feel attraction to another woman. In fact, once she saw that I was completely happy and fully satisfied to be exclusively with her, anything became possible. As a result, we developed the relationship I'd been looking for the whole time, only I didn't know what it was. A relationship without fear. Without fear of intimacy, without fear of suffocation, without fear of loss, without fear of speaking our truth, without fear of being hurt, without fear of boredom, without fear of change, without fear of the future, without fear of conflict, and even without fear of other people. The opposite of fear is not joy, it is acceptance. And that is what we've replaced the fear with. So our commitment today is to neither monogamy nor non-monogamy. Those are other people's values and dichotomies. Our commitment is solely to nurturing, supporting, and honoring three important entities in our lives: me, her, and the relationship. Whatever it takes, and however we may change. Call it a non-dualistic relationship. "How are you handling all the temptation?" Calvin asks. His eyes direct my gaze to a woman with long black hair, pink headphones, and a zebra-striped bikini jogging past. "I still get tempted, but I just decide to wait a little while before opening any doors or doing anything stupid. Soon the temptation goes away, and soon I realize the trust I have with Ingrid, and where that can go, is much more powerful than a few moments of pleasure followed by a lifetime of shame. I've come to realize that there's no so-called natural way to be in a relationship. The whole idea that we can study the past or other cultures to determine what's right for us today is ridiculous. Because nearly every society of simians tells a different story of mating and sexuality, and every point of view can be supported with evidence from some other tribe or species. There isn't just one true and proper way to love, to relate, to bond, to touch. Any style of relationship is the right one, as long as it's a decision made by the whole person and not the hole in the person. The path of ambivalence leads nowhere. So, what would you do if the most beautiful woman in the world hit on you right now? Troy asks. And what about porn? Calvin adds. Or what if Ingrid loses interest in sex altogether? Adam tries. It's interesting. All these issues that were so important and perplexing in rehab don't actually matter anymore. The answer to all of them is, they're the wrong questions. Here's what I'm doing, I explain. I'm honest about everything, and so is she. There are no secrets. So we just discuss those things like we should have in the first place. In fact, the exact things I used to be the most scared to talk about actually brought us closer together once we got past the initial awkwardness. It was the not knowing that was driving her the most crazy. Eventually, she felt safe enough to share her deepest fantasies. And it turned out that some of them weren't all that different from mine anyway. The beach ends at a cliff that marks the northern tip of Point Doom. Just around the cliff is a wide, empty beach, and I ask the guys if they want to swim around to the other side. I don't want you to die on your wedding day, Adam replies, and seems to mean it. We take off our shirts and wade into the water in a safer spot. The waves crash 10 yards out from the shore, and we playfully tumble with them to the sand a few times. How are things with your wife? I ask Adam as we sit on the shore afterward, drying off in the sun. She finally started having sex with me again, he says. No way. So was it worth the wait? I'll tell you, Neil, it really wasn't. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 3 at best. Troy laughs cruelly. So many men like Adam complain that their wives won't have sex with them, yet so few of them would be satisfied if their wives did. Because the problem isn't actually the sex. It's the relationship between the people having it. You should watch instructional videos together, Calvin suggests, or get her really drunk. That's okay, Adam sighs. I really can't change my wife. She is who she is, and I have to start thinking about what's next. Wow, really? I exclaim. You know, he says, burying his feet in the sand, recently I had to wear a Holter monitor because my heart started randomly fluttering, sometimes for 5 minutes straight. So either I leave this marriage, or I have a good risk of a heart attack. So which one are you going to choose? I've rehearsed the conversation I'm going to have with the kids, but I want to wait until our youngest is out of the house in 2 years, and then do it. 2 years? Calvin interjects. You could be dead by then. What's wrong with you? What about you, Calvin? Troy rises to Adam's defense. As soon as you develop feelings for someone, you can't even have sex with them. What are you doing about that? More than you're doing about your affair. I listen as Calvin says that he wants to find his soulmate, and Adam says that he truly is ready to move on, and Troy says that the modern human isn't designed for lifelong monogamy. Their voices mingle with the sea, blurring, blending, and ringing like music. As we walk back up to the house so I can change into my tuxedo, I get the feeling that this is the last meeting of the Red Demons. It takes commitment to change. for only in commitment is there freedom. And it is time, finally, to commit. Check-in, the only emotion on the list of eight that I never checked in with at rehab. Love. Special note to Ingrid. I hope you ignored the message at the beginning of the book and read everything. I wrote that years ago, when I started working on this, when I knew so little about love, sex, relationships, and intimacy. But I want you to know the real me. After all, you're stuck with me for a long time, no matter what Helen Fisher says. Acknowledgements. There are times when I'm in the bathroom with Ingrid, getting ready for the day, and I'm so happy I get what we've come to call an ROL, a rush of love. In those moments, I think about how Rick tried to convince me I was missing out on a bigger happiness and how cynical I was about it. I had no way of understanding what he meant until I experienced it for myself. And now, not a day goes by that I'm not grateful. So I would like to thank, from the bottom of my heart, now that I know I have one, everyone who made it possible. I'm currently keeping an open and expanding list of recommended websites, workshops, and practitioners at www.neilstrauss.com/the-truth. I have a detailed reading list there, as well as information on trauma healing workshops that offer scholarships for those who don't have book advances to spend. In an early draft of the book, when I thought it was going in another direction, I put together an appendix of all the different relationship styles I could find. And you can grab that at neilstrauss.com/goodtimes. I'd like to thank the following actors for helping to keep you awake during the reading of this book. Justin Gunn, Jessica Saddleberger, Mem Kennedy, Carola Mattis, Leah Savoli, Adele Jacques, Ione Sky Lee, John Runette. Everyone else I'd like to acknowledge is already in the book. I'd especially like to thank them for putting up with me as I drove them nuts during this process of growing up. And finally, I'd like to welcome Ten Strauss to the world. As I write this, he is 3 weeks away from being born. Last night, I wrote him a letter, letting him know that no matter what may happen over the course of his life, he was conceived and brought into this world with pure love and absolute joy. I hope he grows up to make someone as happy as his mom makes me.
The best thing we can do for our relationships with others is to render our relationship to ourselves more conscious. This is not a narcissistic activity. In fact, it will prove to be the most loving thing we can do for the other. The greatest gift to others is our own best selves. Thus, paradoxically, if we are to serve relationship well, we are obliged to affirm our individual journey. James Hollis, The Eden Project. This production of The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships, was directed by John Runette and recorded at Village Studios in Los Angeles. Engineered by Jared Nugent. It was produced by We're Rolling Productions. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2015 by Stately Plump Buck Mulligan. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.